You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education podcast. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined in London by J. Noah Brown, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Association of Community College Trustees, which works to enhance the image of the US's community colleges, of which there are roughly 1,200 in total. I understand you're in the UK attending the World Skills UK convention in Birmingham, but have taken a bit of time out to speak with us here. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
No, not at all. How was the conference?
The World Skills was a real eye-opener. It's massive. And I wandered through there and also attended some sessions that were going on concurrently. But what I saw there were thousands and thousands of programs for students in virtually every field you can think of. They're mostly vocational technical fields. Mm-hmm. But I saw students learning auto mechanics, I saw masonry, mm-hmm. I saw cosmetics, or I guess you would call it the beauty industry. Mm-hmm. I actually saw the BBC was there and had one of their trucks, and students were learning about the world of broadcasting. It's just phenomenal. And I was impressed not only by the scale, but the opportunity to expose young people in Britain to the potential of what is available in terms of vocational and technical programs throughout the UK. I'm not sure we have anything like that in the United States.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your organization, the ACCT, represents boards of governors of community colleges in the US. We do cover them fairly regularly in the magazine, but I guess this is a chance to sort of ask you in that position, what sort of big challenges are facing community colleges at the moment? We hear about smaller colleges closing down, we hear about completion rates of US degrees all the time. What for you in that particular sector are the big issues at the moment?
Sure. Well, we exist within the US higher education system, so we're facing the similar challenges. I would say the big challenge that has been building for some time is overfunding. Our institutions are largely financed through state and local funds, taxpayer dollars, in addition to tuition and fees. And the percentage of state and local funds have been declining virtually every year for a number of years. For example, where a college may have gotten, say, 40% of its support from the state, it may now be receiving 12%. Mm-hmm. So there's a big differential that has to be made up. So financial pressure is a huge concern. The second big concern that you mentioned is the completion challenge. Mm-hmm. We, at my organization and community colleges generally, about 4 years ago, have committed ourselves to really taking a look inside of our institutions and to ask the questions about why so many students stop in and stop out, or why so few students persist to earn a degree or a certificate, or for that matter, transfer to a four-year college or university. So we have major initiatives looking at that right now. And frankly, some of it comes down to common sense. We do not do the job that we should be doing, really helping students understand college, how to navigate college. We assess students when they come to us in terms of their math and English abilities. And shockingly, about 60%, that's 60% of the students who come to our institutions cannot pass our basic math and English exams, which means coming out of our high schools, even with a high school diploma, they're not ready for college level. And so we have to put them in what we call developmental education. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's very frustrating and demoralizing for students, and we lose a lot of students. So one of the things we're looking at in the U.S. is how better can we work with what we call our K-12 sector, our kindergarten through 12th grade sector, to really address that deficit so that students come out of high school ready for college, and then we believe they will persist and be more successful and our completion rates will go up.
Sure. I mean, is that an easy job? I mean, over here we have similar problems, and certainly a lot of universities express concern that incoming students don't have the skills that they expect. But I suspect that 60% figure would still come as a surprise to them. It sounds like almost a school education needs a complete rethink before you even start looking at the university completion rates.
Well, there's, yes, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. You may recall when George Bush was president a few years ago, his signature education bill was called No Child Left Behind, which was to build in some standardized testing at different intervals to try to make sure that students were performing. It was very badly implemented, in my opinion, and it was never funded adequately, and therefore what we ended up with were lots of tests, but not a lot of curricular reform or alignment within the system. So we really, in some sense, complicated what was already a not so good situation. But it is a tremendous challenge, and of course, in the States, our education system is decentralized. We don't have a national education system. It was designed in our United States Constitution by the founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and others, that education would be primarily a function of the states. And therefore, if you're looking for systemic reform across all 50 states, that's very difficult.
Yeah, I spoke to Robert Zemsky actually not long ago, a long time.
Sure, Bob Zemsky.
Indeed, yeah, he sort of highlighted in his recent book three sort of fundamental problems with UHE, and one of them was the ineffectiveness of federal government. So it's not a big surprise to hear that. But of course, Barack Obama, you mentioned the previous president. Let's talk about the current one.
Mm-hmm.
He unveiled recently a new, well, it's called variously a scorecard, a rating system, linking
right.
college sort of effectiveness to their outcomes.
Sure.
I mean, what in the community college world, what did you make of this particular announcement?
Well, I mean, we knew that it was coming, and we do work with the administration. I just have to say it to as an aside that we do work with them, and they have been very, very good partners with us in the community college realm in terms of funding and other programs. However, we do take somewhat of an exception to the rating system because we're very concerned that while our colleges exist within our higher education system, our colleges are very, very diverse in terms of their location, in terms of how they're financed, in terms of their student populations, in terms of their outcomes. So we're very concerned about how one would really assess our institutions across the board, and then how would we disaggregate ourselves from the rest of higher education, which is quite a bit different. So we're concerned about how this will play out, and I suppose, as we say in the States, you may say it here in the UK, the devil is in the details.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. But I mean, what you're alluding to there, presumably, is institutions such as MIT, Harvard, Stanford being judged along the same lines as some of the people in your sector, which certainly from the UK looking over seems to be, you know, a slightly unfair comparison.
Right. Now, the administration has given us assurances that it's not their intention to do one-to-one comparison.
Mm.
They understand quite well that we have very different sectors. However, you know, it's one thing to put this out. It's quite another thing to control how it is used broadly. And the concern I have, really, is that there was a study that was done just recently in the States by a group called Public Agenda. And they actually looked at the extent to which students use those kinds of consumer-based data. And what they found is that students, by and large, do not avail themselves of those data. So, of course, in my mind, it kind of begs the question, well, you can create another system, a rating system, call it what you like, but is it going to have any real impact? Or is it going to just kind of make a complex system more complex and less navigable for students in the long run?
Yeah, an interesting point.
Well, you know, I did have the opportunity to meet recently with high-level officials, and I did pose this question.
What did they say out of interest?
They did not respond directly other than to say that they do not have a rating system in the box, that they're building it from scratch. They are in a process right now where they're having some public hearings throughout the states getting input, and we have been testifying and appearing in a number of those. So they say they are open-minded, and they are looking for that kind of information. But, you know, if you think about it, the complexity and the scope potentially of such a system makes one think that ultimately it would be completely unmanageable unless they actually ratchet down into a smaller number of criteria, and that's what concerns me.
Mm. It strikes me as a bit of a mismatch as well if, as you say, education is such a fiercely regional issue administrated by the states, that any ranking that or rating, or however they term to phrase it, that covers the nation as a whole and that is backed by a federal government, is not comparing like with like.
Well, yes. And the other thing that I can tell you about the situation in America is we have 50 states, but states are relatively competitive. So the state governor, state legislature, they're always looking at what goes on in other states. So if you think about overlaying a national rating system across all 50 states, you can imagine the kinds of discussions and cross-channel communications between governors and others who are now comparing their state to other states, whether regionally or across the country. And while that may be a good thing on one level, I just think it's going to create a lot of angst and a lot of error, a lot of room for misinterpretation. Because, you know, data are tricky. Unless you really know what you're looking at and you're able to disaggregate data precisely and do the kind of cross cuts that you need, looking at big data sets can be very, very misleading.
Sure. Let's look at admissions rates. We had an article recently on smaller US colleges that are in many cases struggling to survive. I know America's university age population is declining from a peak a couple of years ago or so. I think the number of students in US universities dropped by about 2.3% in spring compared to the previous year. Obviously that includes the whole HE sector. What's the picture like in community colleges? Because, you know, in many ways they're a cheaper way of getting HE, and following, you know, a depression or a period of economic difficulty such as we've had in recent years, you might expect them to benefit some extent in terms of intakes.
Well, yes. I mean, clearly, at the beginning of the what we call the Great Recession, which many of us are still struggling under, we did see a huge increase in enrollments in our community colleges. And that was to be expected. If we know anything in our sector, is that our enrollments are counter-cyclical to the economy. So when the economy goes down, enrollments go up. And for the obvious reasons, people, they're having difficulty finding jobs. They seek higher education to retrain or retool, or frankly, as a way of stopping out of the labor force until the labor force can improve and get some additional skills. But now, so we saw greater than double digit enrollment gains in, say, 2009, 10, 11, and midway through 2012. Mm-hmm. Now we're in a situation where my institutions are reporting, by and large, a drop in enrollment. So that surge has ended. So as the economy begins to turn around and unemployment begins to drop, consumer spending is going up. We're seeing a decline in enrollment. And this is creates additional problems, as we spoke about a moment ago, in terms of our funding challenge. Now our enrollment is declining.
Alongside the regional government's funding as well.
Exactly. So now we've got, we're, as we say, between a rock and a hard place. You know, the thing that your listeners need to understand is that about two-thirds of our 1,200 community colleges throughout the U.S. are based primarily in small and rural areas. These are very small colleges with 400 or 500 students. I'm worrying a lot about those institutions' abilities to survive in a student market that may be declining, as well as a market in which, you know, we do well to stabilize public funding, never mind try to reverse it. Mm. So I worry a lot about that.
Sure. And what about the threat of online education? Again, it's a topic that obviously sort of segregates a lot of opinion. You get a lot of people who are really quite passionate about the potential for courses that are increasingly available online and increasingly for free as well, impacting on
right.
people actually going to colleges. People ask questions, why would you go to a community college when you can get Harvard courses, Stanford courses online, in many cases for free these days? I mean, is that another palpable challenge to you, or is that something that's more sort of...
Yeah. You know, well, first of all, I'll make two basic points. First of all, we keep talking about distance education, online learning, as if it's in the future yet to come. It's actually been very pervasive and widespread in American higher education, and I assume in the UK as well, for many, many years.
Absolutely.
So it's always going to have market share in that respect. There are always going to be students for whom online learning or distance education works well. You're talking about self-directed students, disciplined students, students who have access to the technology. That's great, and we've had that, and that's relatively non-controversial within the sector. But the new development, which you're referring to, is what we call MOOCs, Massive Online Open Courses. It's a terrible name. I mean, why would anybody want to get involved with anything called MOOC? But nonetheless, I do see the appeal, as you alluded. You could take a class developed by Harvard. You may not ever get into Harvard, but now you can take a free class from Harvard, and that's pretty good, too. I wrote an op-ed recently in Inside Higher Ed back in the spring, and I was asked, you know, what do I think about MOOCs? And I made it several points, not the least of which is I think it's way too premature to know what impact MOOCs will have, particularly in our sector when we have such a transient student population and a student population for whom the digital divide is still real. So they don't have access to the technology, and frankly, their skill sets and their academic levels are not nearly where they should be to be successful, in my opinion, in online learning. So the two points were online learning has always been out there, but this MOOC thing, it's too new to know really how that's going to play out in our institutions. And by the way, yes, you could take a class, a free MOOC from Harvard, but you won't get any college credit for that course unless you enroll through an institution that has acquired the ability to give grant credit for that course. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of a catch there. It's not free college.
Absolutely. No.
Not like you used to have in the UK, which I understand doesn't exist anymore.
Not by a long shot. Indeed. I should ask you about your book, which was out last year. It's called First in the World, Community Colleges and America's Future. It sounds like an all-encompassing title. What does it focus on? What of community colleges and America's future?
Yeah, first of all, I was asked to write this book as part of a series. That was very exciting because it wasn't on my, as we say in the States, on my bucket list to write a book. But when the situation presented itself and I thought about the opportunity, it was very exciting, and it's been very gratifying to have the book out and know that it's being read and talked about. So the title, First in the World, is really a double entendre, and it refers to two things. First, a lot of the book focuses on the fact that in the United States, our educational attainment rates have not really moved significantly since the 1970s. So in the 1970s, the U.S. was number one in the world with the proportion of 18 to 34-year-olds with a college credential. Today, we find ourselves 16th in the world. And it's primarily because we are not increasing that number relative to our population growth. Mm-hmm. Why is that significant? Because it has profound implications for our economy and our ability to be competitive in an increasing knowledge-based society. Secondly, so the title, first of all, is we're not first in the world, but I'd very much like us to be. And the second meaning is that American community colleges were the first of their kind in the world. They're uniquely American, they're uniquely democratic, they're uniquely locally administered and governed, And nothing like that existed in the world before we invented them. And now I spend a lot of time meeting with people from around the world who are keenly interested in what they can take from our experience to replicate in their own countries, because it is a powerful, a democratic model for building kind of a core economic and education infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So the title is really those two things. It's the need to be first in the world when it comes to attainment, and a reminder that we have something that was first in the world that has worked well for us. And so the book basically talks about our challenges, but then the final chapter, I go back to the end of the Second World War, and I retrace our history as a nation in terms of those huge national investments we made to build our post-secondary sector, and how that contributed to us building the most prosperous economy the world has ever known for 50 years, and then kind of end up with the question, are we prepared to do this again? Because if we don't, being first in the world won't be something that we can pride ourselves about.
Sure. So a great system that deserves celebrating.
Yes. I mean, I think that the system is incredible. And I think it's done incredible things for our country, and it has really democratized a higher education, which is, you know, a very American tradition. Just like our institutions pride themselves on being what we call open access. So as long as you have a high school diploma or its equivalent, you may come into our institutions. It's not like the elite institutions where you have to have, you know, very high grade point averages. You have to score very high on our two primary college admissions exams. Never mind all the extracurricular activities and the letters of recommendation and, mm-hmm. you know, what makes you special relative to 20 million other young people who want to come to college kind of thing. We take virtually everybody and try to help them go where they're trying to go.
Well, Mr. Barron, it's been a pleasure to meet you, and thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.